Okay.
Well, they don't have any volume.
Yeah. Hello?
Uh-huh.
All right.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Of course.
Yeah.
So, the project started in the 97, actually. And at the time, OpenBSD was already ported with, well, ported. It just forked from NetBSD, basically. So it supported pretty much everything. NetBSD supported at the time, plus some private company hired some OpenBSD developers to port it to the Logan RISC platform, but it never made to public market. So some proprietary RISC design here. So why would we want to port it to another platform? That would be the major question in this case. And one of the reasons is because HPB is very different, because, for example, unlike most of the platforms, except for MIPS platforms maybe, it has incoherent input I/O. So every time DMA happens, whatever has been in the CPU cache is not anyhow synced to what is being DMA'd into the memory and otherwise. If the CPU writes something into memory, it gets stuck in the cache and not necessarily yet in the memory. So that has to be put in account when the whole device driver infrastructure develops. Then it has very different application binary interface compared to other architectures. For example, the stack grows up instead of growing down. And then for their CPU clocks, the machines are quite fast. They are much faster than Spark machines on a normal usage. They are comparable to PowerPC machines of a little bit higher clocks. They are much faster than Intel machines, for example, about twice as much, twice the difference on the CPU clock, basically. So 180 megahertz HPB does about the same speed as a 300-450 megahertz Intel CPU on just the CPU tasks. And then, of course, there is always a reason that it never been done before. There have been a private port done by Mike Hibbler and the other group in the Carnegie Mellon University, but it never been released because it partially contained code from HPX. Plus, they also done several other ports to PRE's platform, but they were all Carnegie Mellon March microkernel designs, which is not exactly normal BSD operating system. So, a little bit about the PRISC history. The first CPUs, they were released in 86, that is about a year after the MIPS was released, and about a year before the first Spark CPU was released. And the first version of the CPU architecture was, of course, 1.0, but it was substantially different from what came later as 1.1 version of architecture. And then 1.1 version, which came a couple of years later, I think, then they just put the additional letter after 1.1, A, B, C, D, for different CPU development line, they got up to 96 when they switched to 64-bit CPUs. And then PRISC 2.0 version, it was all completely new design. They redesigned the whole CPU, and it was also 64-bit CPUs. But those came about 1996, and they're still making them. They plan to make them for about another 5 years, then they can abandon the whole thing. So for 2.0, there is a book, Precision. Hewlett-Packard Precision Architecture RISC 2.0. It's also available in PDF and HTML on HP site if you want to download and read it. And same for 1.1 architecture, that's a different book. But the problem with the book is that it describes just a subset of architecture which is pretty much usable only for the user programming, not for kernel programming. It doesn't contain descriptions for the CPU operation instructions and lots of other stuff. So what kind of machines were made with the CPUs? They made all kinds of different machines. They made very small ones. For example, 712 model is about the size of workstation 2, except it's plastic and it weighs like 5 kilograms. And fits one hard drive, one floppy drive, and has very small motherboard about this size. And it's very useful. It's about 110 watts electricity consuming, and it has everything on board. It's pretty much one solid unit, but it's very useful for small externals, small routers, small web servers. People make DNS servers on that. They're reasonably fast. They're about the speed of Pentium 200, Pentium like 160, something like that. And then our port supported pretty much everything except for very, very old ones. Oh, that's the typo. They should be 1.1 machines, but anyway. The 705 and 710, 720, 730, 750, they are very first machines made with the PRS 1.1, and they're really hard to come by. So if anybody has one, you have an opportunity to contribute code to OpenVXT by fixing it. So then there are two very interesting machines which you commonly can find on eBay. There is the RDI made the Precision Book. It's the same company that made the SparkBook. It's the same case as SparkBook. So the black laptop kind of case, and even the keyboard mapping is the same as on Spark. Cups and controller swapped, and lots of other keys are swapped. So right away, the keyboard is not very useful because, for example, backspace doesn't work, and some other keys don't work, like the slash doesn't work, and the stick doesn't work. So you have to lower the key map or switch the key map before you can do anything, even in a single user. But ever useful, the battery is, of course, about 20 minutes working time, but it has two hard drive slots, floppy, external floppy, onboard internet, and has video, decent video. We support it as well. And it has the card bus slots, which we support as well, so you can have wireless, for example. And the SAIC is actually a military company. They make all kinds of radar equipment and all that stuff for military, but as a part of that, they made the PRS-based mobile wireless workstation for testing all this funny military stuff. It's not a laptop, but it's about the size of a laptop, just this thick. And it's probably unbreakable. The plastic, you can't burn it, you can't scratch it, nothing happens to it. It has a little tiny LCD in there, 640 by 480. And pretty much it's just the 712 workstation put in this super duper plastic unbreakable case. But often you can find it on eBay as well, and they're very funny. Partially because they have video and keyboard in there, and the mouse and everything. It's like a workstation, but portable. And that's the website. There is the Weissman Maintains, which has pretty much everything you want to know about all kinds of PRS machines and other hardware. And he was a big support the whole time, writing documentation and all that stuff. So what kind of CPU is it? The CPU is very straightforward, at least, without any fancy stuff. It's just 32 normal registers, 32 control registers, not even 30, well, they numbered 1 to 32, but there is a gap in the middle, so it's 20 in there. And one of the registers is just a timer which generates the interrupt, which is used for normal Unix process scheduling and there is no shadow registers, there is nothing like that. There is no window registers, none of those. It's just 32, that's it. And the APU, since the early days, they integrated the APU with the CPU. And the APU is very fast. The slowest possible, the longest possible instruction, that's, I think, multiplies 15 cycles. And this APU can operate independently of CPU, so while it does its multiply, CPU can run and do all the other stuff, whatever it has to do. And it also has 32 64-bit floating point registers, which also could be 64 32-bit, again, floating point or integer registers. And again, no register windows, no context switching hardware, nothing. Well, no MMU is a joke. Of course there is MMU. So what kind of MMU is? The virtual space is divided in a 32,000 spaces basically. You can think of it as an extension to the address. So 32 bit normal address, and then there are 15 bits on top of it, which specify whose space is that. The zero space is the kernel, and all the others is the user processes or could be kernel threads. Well, that's not. This is not really that much, but the 1.0 theories, they only had 12 bits for the spaces, so there's like 4,000 processes. That's not very useful at all. So the 1.1 is much more useful, and at least has decent amount of processes we can run simultaneously. And there is no hardware page table. Kind of, I guess, like the PowerPCs and the, well, on Spark there is a little support, but still. But except on some CPUs, they implemented the page table. So when the page fault happens, CPU has a pointer to the hash table where it creates a hash out of the virtual address and space and look in the hash. If there is matching entry, it loads up an entry, which is usually about 11 clocks. And even the fastest possible way implemented software TLB insert handler, it's at least 20, 30 clocks. So we have about 3 times speed up in case we use the hash table, but then we have overheads because we have to update the hash table. So the current port contains the code for that experimental code, which is not enabled by default. And the on say extensive file operation, it helps a lot. But doing just plain compilation or heavy computational, heavy memory usage applications doesn't help very much at all. It actually slows down a little bit. So it's a questionable. And the way HPX used it, they had the hash table built as a hash table with a linked list hanging off the hash buckets. So in case the page fault happens and the kernel couldn't find the entry in the hash table, it calls the TLB handler, which just walks down the list and pulls out the entry which is corresponds to the fault address, which didn't really work very well because you have to walk the list all the time. And the more processes you have, the more virtual space is used, the longer the list. And in 98, I think, they conducted a huge research at the HP. What is better, the multi-level page table, like the Intel has, for example, or the hash table page table? Of course, they don't publish the results. It's a super duper HP secret. But we all know the multi-level pages are better than the hash tables. And also, there is a similar thing as, say, on PowerPC. There are block TLB entries, which means you can map more than one page with one entry. So you can map up to, I think, 256 megabytes with one TLB entry, but in that case, physical space has to be continuous as well. This is just useful for frame buffers mapping, usually, not very much for anything else. How do interrupts work? Unlike, say, the Intel architecture is a completely message-based. So instead of pulling out the line or pulling down the line or doing anything like electrical, devices just write a word into the CPU register, external CPU register. And CPU says, oh, okay, there was an interrupt on that bit. And there is a 32-bit interrupt register and just pulls out the bits. And also, another benefit of that is that the interrupt messages could be unicast, so they could be directed to particular CPU. Or they could be broadcast, they could be sent to all the CPUs, which is useful in the SMP case, because one CPU could be already running something at the higher privilege level and couldn't take this interrupt, so another CPU could take it without the extra overhead for scheduling interrupts between CPUs. But the native bus called GSC, General System Connect, It implements signal interrupts. So the whole system is combination of all kinds of different stuff. So we have devices like SCSI and Ethernet which pull the lines, which get translated into hosting messages in the CPU. Partially because the GAC bus was developed out of EISA bus. They just said, well, the EISA is stupid, this is standard, we don't want to follow standards. We want to make our own super duper fast bus. They made it. Plus, they added support for coherent I.O. So, devices and the particular CPU models that implement that, they can implement coherent protocol for baking cache memory as well as the main memory during the DNA. Plus, they raised the clock up to 40 megahertz. And they allowed several devices to be active at the bus at the same time, which I don't think EISA supported. Well, LoMIO is memory, all the registers of the devices are mapped in the memory, similar as in most of the normal architectures, without all the separate I.O. spaces and the memory spaces. Also, is a huge benefit is that the memory bus is 64-bit, even though the CPU is 32. And the memory bus usually calculated about the CPU speed, so on the CPUs that are faster than 120 MHz, memory bus is usually 120, which is for, say, even 96 was pretty much not very bad. Even compared to today, 120 MHz memory bus is not so bad. Also, the way the cache was implemented over time, it's a, the cache is external to CPU, it's a separate chips. But it's always level one cache. But on the later CPUs, they went for the two-level caches because the clock got much faster than the memory clock, so it makes sense to have two levels of caches. So they usually have small level one cache, like 64 and plus 64 kilobytes, and then they have second-level cache, like 1 megabyte or 4 megabytes. And that was implemented in the memory controller. So the level 2 cache is, CPU doesn't really control it. It's more or less a transparent thing. Well, what kind of buses is all built with? The main bus where the CPU is, the memory is, and the secondary bus controllers are, as it was mentioned before, it is, yes, 64-bit. And the on the same bus, you can have up to four CPUs which talk to each other. They broadcast the messages about the cache updates. They broadcast the messages about TLB updates. So you don't have to worry about that much, at least. Because the whole PRISC idea is that the CPU design is very simple. Whatever has to be done is done in user code, or whatever people write, programmers write. So, and that kind of pays off because the CPU itself is very, very fast. It can run the code properly written, assuming the concurrency that the CPU can do. It can run more than one command at a time, up to three at the time, technically. And the GAC bus, where most of the devices are, is again up to 40 megahertz. Support multiple transactions and sometimes coherent DMA on some machines. Plus, later they extended the bus, they call it the high speed connect bus, HSC, which is a high clock and a pretty much the same idea. It's EISA bus modified for whatever HP thought the bus should be. And the very old machines, they based on their own HP precision bus, which is completely undocumented. They had docs in the HP, but they just can't make it to release it properly. But HP precision bus is a kind of like VME cage. It's a cards with the slats with the connectors on the back. Also full size and the half size. And they have a whole kinds of devices for that, but they could have just went with VME and then make everybody happy. But graphics is a very very strong point on all HP machines. First of all, every graphics card is just separate CPU. It supports asynchronous operations, so it could be given the old saying, write this part of the screen, whatever, map these characters in the font and right there, and at the same time, when you finish, you send me interrupt back. So it's kind of like a scanning, basically. You don't have to wait for anything, you just submit a request there and they get the results back when it's complete. And you just follow the order so you don't write something before something else finished that is supposed to be before that. And the firmware on the graphics card supports very simple interface, which is the same on all the kinds of graphic cards they have, which allows drawing character, mapping characters into through the font into the screen, moving parts of this, copying parts of the screen, reading parts and part of the screen, writing back part of the screen, scrolling the screen, which is pretty much everything we need for console operation. And on later firmware, they even put the X11 driver in there. So when the X server starts up, it just fetches the driver from the firmware and there. It has the best possible acceleration and everything. But the cards themselves, they can do much more. Even in the 94, say, even 93, they had the cards which already were doing heavy graphics processing, the 3D mapping, the texture mapping, all kinds of stuff. Initially, the first versions of the graphics, they were actually separate boxes. It was a box about the size of average RAID array you can find today, which is external cable to the main unit, and then it has BNCs on the back, you hook up to the screen, and there's a huge separate computer which does all your graphics needs, but they don't have those anymore, they just make these small cards. And again, proprietary design, there is documentation for the simple PROM interface, but say, there is no documentation for the registers, how do we write a X3 driver, for example. For that, there is no documentation at all. The best we can do for X3 driver is to know how efficiently to copy part of the screen to another part of the screen. That's the best acceleration we can get. But apparently, the card can do much more. With all that hardware, how does it boot? So, since the HP 300, they have invented these file format, which is, I think, logical interchange format or file. It's basically file system within the file. It has a little header, it has a little directory, and then it has a little file, which is your boot block or internal, or HPX applies all kinds of utilities in there, like standalone file system check and standalone copy and all kinds of stuff. And the benefit of this approach is that it can boot with the same image, it can boot from anywhere. You put the image on the network, it TTPs image from the network. The same image. You DD the image to the tape, and it can boot from the tape. You can burn the same image onto CD, and it can boot from CD-ROM. Or the same with the hard drives, obviously. There is one little thing with the all the machines they use special HP R-boot-D protocol, which is used on the HP 300 machines as well, so if anybody uses those, that's easy. But then ABSD has, I'm not sure if ABSD has it, but ABSD OpenBSD has it, R-boot-D, which allows doing that. R-boot-D is pretty much a combination of TFTP and the boot-D. What gives the IP address to the client machine and allows block level access to whatever files are there in the boot area. And the newer machines, they all use TFTP, BootP, it's easy. And then the user land, up to the 10th version of HPX, they use their own SOM format, which is extension of AOUT. It has extra header. Before that, to describe all the extra sections in the file and all the kinds of stuff which is needed for the way HP envisioned would be better for user. But apparently, they later went to ELF as well. We just went to ELF in the beginning because nobody wanted to write some support just for one platform. Who cares? You already have EOR. Then VIX-11, we still don't have work. Well, clients work, yes, you can manage to remotely from a machine, but the server doesn't work. And it doesn't work in a very funny way. The first about 62 kilobytes of frame buffer works. As soon as you try access something behind it, and the number is completely uneven. It's not a point, a power of 2, it's not power of 10, it's like 62753 or something like that. So nobody knows. But then again, the graphics card, they have their own MMU. The frame buffer is mapped into the CPU space through the graphics card MMU. So every time access happens, there is a little page fault happens on the video card, and the video card remaps somehow pages of the frame buffer. And they, for text mode, they have an abstraction of a text mode where you don't have to think about actual bits representation. You just say, okay, write the dot there with the current color or whatever, and it just keeps the color there. And then they have a normal frame buffer where they have a like 8 or 16 or 24 or 32 bits per pixel in whatever configuration. You can actually configure it in all different ways. You can say, I want to update only low 4 bits in every pixel. So it maps you the frame buffer such that you write linearly, but it updates only the 4 bits in every pixel. And all kinds of stuff. Or you want to update every even bit in 32 bit per pixel frame buffer, and it maps you the frame buffer in such a way that every bit is actually mapped in the every even bit in the pixel. But again, we don't know how to do it. Nobody knows except HP. They don't want to share that knowledge. And the ABI is different. The stack grows up. What that means that about 5 or 6 places around the kernel, the completely machine independent places, we had to put in this. If machine stack grows up, do calculations this way, or do calculations that way. And we actually maintain the notion of the bottom and top of the stack the same way it is for the normal stack. But the way the calculations are made, it somehow just works. It's magic. I know, I wrote it and it worked. And I never understood how it works, but it works. And but it's not that really much of a changes in the kernel. We thought it's going to be major pain, but apparently we're just about 5-6 places. And of course, machine dependent part has to be different anyway, so it wasn't much of a problem. One of the side effects of that is that Propolis doesn't work on HPPA with GCC. I don't know how much you're familiar with that, but GCC version that we're using has Propolis for practically all the architectures enabled by default. For HPPA it doesn't work because it assumes that the current frame is below everything else. But in HPPA the current frame is on the top of the, on the highest address on the stack. But it doesn't really change anything security-wise because all we have to worry about is the overflowing buffers and the calling function instead of the function which is currently being executed. So all the exploits are pretty much the same with the difference that the return addresses are in the different places and we have to just plan the whole exploit differently. So I don't know if HP thought that's going to save them from buffer overflows. Well, it doesn't. And the HPX implement very funny virtual space mapping. They divide the whole 32-bit space into 1 gigabyte spaces. And they say, okay, the lowest gigabyte is where the user program runs, the user code is located. And next gigabyte is where the user data is located. And user stack is located. And the third gigabyte is where the shared libraries are mapped. And then the fourth gigabyte is where the kernel publishes all the stuff it wants to publish to user. But I don't think they even use it for ages. Maybe in the beginning they used it, but then they abandoned it. Because first of all, with this approach, instead of wasting 1 space ID per process, we waste 4 space ID per process. So we're back to 2,000 processes total. So you just waste, even though for shared space we can reuse space ID probably between the same shared libraries mapped the same way for different, but I don't think that would work very well. And this is the simple way how the system call works. This is the reason I brought it up, there was a very funny bug in there. So the reason it works, I'll explain a little bit. The left part is what happens in user land. The right part is what's going to happen in kernel. So the first instructions do, they load the address where the system called pages, because it's made through the jump to the special last page. And then there is a branch, BLE, it's a branch link external, so it branches and it puts the return address in the register. And the HPB implements the delay slots, same as the MIPS does, Spark does, PowerPC does. So the next instruction of the branch is actually executed before the branch happens. And they say, because it was about the same time of the MIPS wanted to be before HP releases their own RISC. So they said, oh, well, screw the register interlocking. So they completely avoided register interlocking in the early MIPS CPU. So say, for example, instead of R1 in the middle instruction, we would use T1. So what would happen? The loading of T1 would happen before it is used, because if there is no register interlocking, it would jump not the way we would think it jumped. You would have to load T1 before you separate different registers, as we say, using it here. So, but HP implemented the interlocking, so you don't have to think about that. On the MIPS, we have to think what's going to happen, how the instructions going to be executed, even though we know how the control flow happens. So anyway, when the branch happens, it ends up on this special page, on the gate instruction. And the way page is mapped with the permissions that the privilege level could be promoted from user level to, say, kernel level, to the file level. And but at that time, we are still running with user privileges. Then we have a special instruction, which is called gate, which promotes the privilege level. And then we end up with the label BSD syscall, and now we can execute the privileged instructions which are running in the kernel mode then. But the bug we had was very funny, because the interrupt happens after the branch executed, but before the gate happened. So technically, we are already running on the kernel mode code, but we are still in the user space. So the interrupt handler, the way I wrote it, it kind of ignored these things. So it just looked, oh, okay, what's the privilege of the code we are running? Okay, the code is running in the kernel, but we are not in the kernel yet. So we end up in the wrong stack, and the whole system crashes, and it's very evil. And so the way it was fixed, that you look both at the address where it happened and the privilege level of the code that is being executed. It just extra check, but just kind of funny bug which we couldn't find for about half a year. Actually, we didn't find it until NetBeef deported our port, and then Mark Friedan, who did the port, he fixed it. And they comment like 10 lines long explaining how this whole thing works. So, okay, thank you, Mark Friedan. Now it works much better. So, no, we just do extra checks where the pull happened, because this is the only place in the whole kernel where this kind of scenario can happen, or user space. So we just check, did it happen in those address range? Because this page is mapped at the fixed address, so the user land can jump there without letting kernel pass it the address where to jump, and without this whole dynamic mess. Even though I think maybe we will change that, because then the page doesn't have to be at a fixed address, it could be anywhere. And you don't have to waste address space, and there were some other reasons I forgot. So privilege level elevation is a two-step process which is not the same as, say, in most of other architectures. And because there is no hardware context switching, there is no assumed any kind of backstage operations happening. The mode of CPU just anytime, in this case, we just jump. CPU didn't do any extra work. So technically, we don't have to save all the registers, because we know we are being called from the function, and we're going to be calling another C function. So we just maintain the whole convention for a C function calling, and we don't have to save half of the registers. which is twice as fast, and we don't have to restore half of the registers, technically, which is half as fast context switching as compared to, say, full context dump and restore, which happens in the other architectures, for example. And similar thing happens with the other faults. Say the page fault happens or interruption happens. Instead of saving all the context, they have this concept of a shadow registers. They have six shadow registers, which another general purpose six registers just copied there once the interruption happens, and then they switch to physical mode, complete physical mode, every kind of virtual addressing disabled. And then apparently six registers is enough to walk the page table load until we proceed, emulate the FPU, half of the FPU instructions, or do partial context saving and emulate the FPU and come back, or collect the interrupt state and then return back to user land. Six registers apparently is more than enough stuff for doing most of the work until we have to call the C code. Okay, shared libs. One of the funniest stuff about shared libs that both PLT and GOAT are both data. There is no code in there. So the stuff we did on most of the other architectures where we make sure that the PLT, which contains little tiny code stubs for calling functions in other shared objects, which is usually like 8 instructions, which get fixed by the dynamic linker to contain proper address for the libraries. On HPD, it's not a code, if we use Intel terminology, it's a long pointer, if anybody remembers that. It's like it's a space ID. No, and not the space, not data, they call it data pointer. It's a pointer where the shared object's data is mapped. So against that pointer, all the data in the shared object could be accessed. So it's a base data pointer. And then the actual function pointer. So the stuff that is used for calling shared functions is the same, and it's in the code segment. We don't have to worry about it being readable or non-executable. It's just always the same thing, the same as the rest of the code. It just goes into the table, pulls out the 2 32-bit values, stash it in the register, and calls the function. And I already said that. And the other problem is we have IMAP randomization, which means that every object that is being mapped, it gets mapped not somewhere linear going down or going up addresses, it gets mapped randomly within 256 megabytes somewhere. But because of the incoherent nature of the whole architecture, there is such a thing as a cache aliasing, which means if you map the same physical page into two different processes, in order to maintain coherency for changes, say one process writes data, which is virtual address, which is mapped to some physical page, and another process wants to read that data, in order to maintain the whole integrity of the process, so the data is not getting corrupted anyhow, the virtual addresses have to be aligned on a 1 megabyte boundary, which means instead of 16 bits of random address portion in case of 256 megabytes, yes, 16, we get only 8. So that's not very much, but otherwise we would really waste the virtual address space, which means we're going to waste the page table, which means much slower virtual memory operation. And now that we already have it running, how we made it running? In the beginning, it was developed just with the cross tools on the Intel box and then put through the network into the HP machine, and then until we got some kind of single user going. And at that point, we using the cross tools, we generated GCC interlocutors for the native system. Once we had that, we then manually compiled make, CP, all kinds of little tiny programs so we can say make orange, make blue, and then everything else works. That was also a little confusing part because the stack goes backwards, well, compared to other architectures. The way arguments are copied from the user stack into the kernel stack during the syscall, all the long words, 64-bit words, they were word swapped. So one of the problems this produces is, say, LSeq. So the file offset in the LSeq has swapped words. So instead of seeking to say 10th byte, we are seeking way beyond 4 gigabytes. And same with mmap. And in the beginning, when I just made the bin modules, everything worked, except the linker produced very funny executables. They always missed the header, and in some cases they didn't have data section, in some cases they had the parsed portions of data sections over the code sections, and the way bin modules write the executable, they write like pieces of it. They don't write the whole text and whole data. So you get these little tiny pieces of text and code and header, everything together, until somebody pointed out, don't you think your LSeq doesn't work? And apparently it didn't. So in the kernel, there is this little piece that, for a few syscalls, there are about 5 of them, which pass long words on the stack in the arguments. We do word swapping for those, and then if you return something, we have to word swap on the stack as well. So in the beginning, it didn't work, and then I asked another guy who had another developer of ours who had the HPX running on his HPPA machines. Could you try building bootstrapping GCC, which means building on HPX, building cross GCC to build OpenBSD binaries, and then with that building OpenBSD GCC. And machines are not very, they are fast, but not that fast. So it took him about half a day building that. But by that time, somebody suggested me swapping the words, and by the time he got the native OpenBSD GCC built on the HPX 3 level bootstrapping, I got this thing fixed, and apparently now LD works. So it was about the same time it took to fix the bug or build the GCC, so maybe I should have just went drinking beer and GCC anyway. And then in the beginning we ran it on the MFS route because they study. Most of the machines they use relatively common SCSI driver, it's just the NCR 710, 753C710, which is the old driver or NCR driver of most of the BSDs. But in the beginning it didn't work, and half of the machines I had, they has not 710, but 700 chip, which we support, but is separate driver, and the first route is not very fast, as you can guess, especially when you have sources and object files on NFS and GCC. And then, of course, we got the SCSI driver. And the fastest machine we support, 32-bit machine, is the 880 or B180 or C180L models. It's a 180 megahertz machine. They usually have about a megabyte of second level cache, and either fast SCSI, which is 10 megahertz, so they have ultra wide SCSI, and the main build goes in about 12 hours, which is not that bad. Say 200 megahertz HyperSpark does main build in 15 hours. And here's a little project we're currently working on, HPX simulation. That is mostly easy, except for the way they do the whole signal stuff. They changed it about 5 times. In the beginning, they had normal signal handling. They had a stop in the kernel, which is mapped into user land, and then the signal handler called through the stack. Then they said, no, you're going to do it the way Solaris does it or System 5 does it. We're going to have a stop in libc. So then again, kernel has to know where to jump. And then they change it a couple of more times. So essentially they have 3 or 4 different versions of a system call, which is given to kernel to get the address where is the signal handler has to return to. That stuff a little, and of course there is no documentation on that either. Not to mention that HPX doesn't have very good manual pages at all. But otherwise it works. Like, say, CPU works, and the, what else works? NVMe, RAM works. But tail doesn't work, because tail relies on the SIP child or something. And the X11 server, again, doesn't work. Well, it works in the first 62 kilobytes. SMP machines, that's a big problem, because they all about 50 kilos weight. Because they thought, well, workstations don't need SMP. Who's going to need SMP on the table? They want a SMP, okay, they have data center, and they have this huge freezer with 8, 16, 128 CPUs, whatever. And the smallest machine which can have two CPUs is the J200 or J210 or 210XC. They can they about the size of a full tower, weigh about 35 kilos each, and they can have two CPUs. But once you support two, you can support four. That's not a big problem, because the protocol is the same, and all the math that has to be done is the same. But again, it's just really hard to support those, especially in summer. HPV64 wrote to the future. They are very fluffy. First of all, the host bridge and the PCI bridge, they are same as used in the Nutanix, which means they are little Indian. Oh, I forgot to mention, HPV is big Indian architecture. So all the devices, except for, of course, PCI devices, which are little Indian, because they made mostly for PCs, and they... most of the EIs, IIs, the devices, most of them are little Indian. But in this case, PCI bridge itself, which is soldered in the motherboard, which is not really changeable or anything, it's little Indian. And it took me a while to figure it out, because apparently they forgot to mention it in the documentation, that they say, yeah, okay, they are meant to be in the future used on the Titanic, but does it mean they have to be little Indian later? But they are 64-bit and they are little India. So on those machines, for example, we cannot run 32-bit kernel, because we have to have atomic 64-bit access to the PCI bridge registers, which we cannot have on the normal 32-bit machines. But some of the older HPV64 machines, they are based on the same architecture as the 32-bit machines. They just swap the CPU. And there are about five of those, which we support at 32-bit mode. They're just very, very fast 32-bit machines. They about, they clock the C360, which is 360 megahertz. It's twice as fast as the, say, C180, which is 180 megahertz. But itself, it's about another 50% faster, because the CPU itself, the 64-bit CPUs, they implement all the modern fluffy features. They support the branch prediction, they support reordering, they have a 56 instructions queue, where they just reorder randomly instructions to achieve the better loading of the CPU. On say 32-bit CPUs, they have three functional units. They have APU, they have ALU for arithmetic, and then they have a address calculation and memory load store units. So you can have at the same time, you can have division happening, or multiplication happening, addition happening, and then something being fetched from a memory, or put in the memory. But on HPV64, they have 10 functional units. They have two ALUs, two APUs, two shift units, two memory access units, and they do something else. And but they can schedule only four at a time. But some instructions can take more time. For example, load store can take up to 15 cycles. So you can have two load or store instructions happening while you're scheduling four other ones on the all other functional units. The HPV64, they implement cache in IO. So when the DMA happens, we don't have to think what happens to the cache. Nothing happens to the cache. Everything's fine, like on the info. Again, much faster CPUs. The first model 8000, they just implemented the branch prediction and reordering a little bit. But the 8500 CPU that came out in about 96 or 97, I think, They also increased the size of caches about twice. Also, it's a level 1 caches on the chip. So it's about 1 clock delay to fetch anything from the cache. And they implemented the reordering was already. They increased the size of TLB. The previous version had the 120, and the next version they made it 160, and the latest version has 240 entries, which is 240 pages could be mapped at the same time, which is pretty much a megabyte, which means almost any system call you can possibly make into the BSD kernel, it all fits in the TLB. You don't get TLB completely flushed before you come back to user land, which is also useful. Which doesn't happen on, say, Intel CPUs, where you have only 32 entries in the TLBs. So that's kind of useless. And the SMP machines are much better. Pretty much every 64-bit machine is SMP. They have paired models. They have same model, one CPU, and then they have similar model, two CPUs. They're just twice as expensive. And but it's the same cases, they are not freezers, they are normal 2U machines. They still weigh about 30 kilos, but again, you cannot break them. When people ship them, they don't pop them. They just put the carton around, some duct tape, and blah, nothing happens. Never. Again, who do you want to thank? Of course, Mike Hibbler, and, because he wrote, 5 times he wrote the port of all kinds of, he wrote the Linux, Linux port, which is a MK Linux, and he did the lights, which is a 4.4 lights port over the Mach kernel. Then they did 4.3 port on HPBS, which is not publicly available, and they did some other stuff which nobody knows about. But still, if those two never been released in public, then nothing of this would probably ever happen, because none of the kernel stuff needed for writing kernel stuff is ever documented. Another very good thing that came out of MK Linux is the APU emulation library, which with the lights it came as the object file, which is not very useful, of course, for all of us. And with the MK Linux, HP released the sources, the mostly assembler sources. And the HP license is always good. Whatever they released, all the code, it's pretty much IEC license. But because MK Linux was developed by OSF, they put the OSF license on top of it, which has a wrong wording in the license. The normal thing with the without fee. Without fee is put in the wrong place, and it could be treated as distributed without fee. So that basically enforces the distribution policy, which is not compatible with whatever license you like it. And James Lovelock, who was the manager of the at least one or two projects they did with Mike Hibbler, he actually went down, he went into his tape archives, he found the original tape that HP gave them in like 94 or something, and he found a piece of paper somewhere in, I don't know where, his apartment, which HP says, blah blah, this could be released under this license, and he said, yes, okay, here is the stuff, and then that took about 2 months to find this all and they finally get it back, but he did it, and very big thanks to him. And Mike Hibbler supported the whole time. So yeah, go ask James Lovelock, he has that stuff. So if he wouldn't say that, we wouldn't find it. And Matt Fredette from the NetBSD project, he's not around anymore, I don't know why, but he did the NetBSD port, and apparently, as it usually happens, when you borrow people's work, you fix bugs in the people's code because people just don't see them. And he fixed the bug with the syscall I mentioned before. He fixed, what the hell, the interrupt handling bug. Well, it wasn't as much of a bug as a misdesign. The way I implemented interrupts initially is a very simple, stupid way, but it worked. All we needed to have is single user. And it worked for single users, so we can start building stuff natively, and somebody except me can actually start doing anything with it. So somebody except me happened to be Matt Fredette, who said, oh, okay, here's good stuff. So he ported it to NetBSD, he fixed the bugs, he released the code, and they, of course, being a good developer, he commented all the bugs. So we just took the bugs, the fixes, we fixed them there, and Now it pretty much works. Hewlett Packard donated a huge pile of hardware. The first time we asked them in the 97, they said, well, we don't like it, we like Linux. Well, okay, you like Linux, you do Linux. So they supported the Linux project, which is initially was done by the Puffin group, the Linux Care, now I think Debian does it. But in that case, their support didn't stop with just the hardware. They actually committed a bunch of HP engineers, and the most critical parts of the kernel were written by HP engineers, which is maybe good because they know what the stuff they're writing, because there is lots of magic in that. You read that code and they say, yeah, it has to be done this way, but we cannot tell you. And you cannot figure out why, it just has to be. Okay, fine. But then, on the other hand, that's a little bit not very well, because, say, HP engineers support today, who's going to support it tomorrow? So the way it works for us right now, it works to some extent and fine, but HP still donated a whole bunch of hardware. We asked them in the 2001, I think, they gave us like 10 boxes, and that's how major building farm and several developers have it. And after that, one developer wrote the sound driver, because he didn't have a box before with the sound device on it. So he got the box with the sound device and said, that's going to be my MP3 machine. It's slow, it doesn't have to be fast. So he wrote the sound driver, and now it works. Another developer said, well, I don't like this stupid phone console we have. Let's write the real workstation console, which we have similar code to NetBeast, for example. So he sat down, he wrote a couple of drivers, and now we have the real console. And another developer got the box, and he said, well, okay, I want to make SCSI much faster. So he said, and he made SCSI work better and faster. So that was very good. And currently they donated HPDA64 machine, which I'm using to make HPDA64 port, and a couple of users from the mailing list, they donated a couple as well, which is Theo has, and they bug me all the time, my machines don't run because the OpenBSD doesn't run. Well, what can I do? I'm working on it. And of course, again, the whole OpenBSD developer community, because, well, Snakes, the original HPDA project was called Snakes. Most of the machines, they have snake names. Like 712 is a gecko, not exactly a snake, but close. And then the 724, I think, is the Cobra, and then King Cobra. And then they have a memory controller, and the only machines with Viper. And what else they have? But then the new machines, they all have hippie names. They are like Rhapsody, and the LG, and some other. I don't know why they did that, but I think the old names are much better. And then again, the begging page. There you make donations, and there we say where you can make and what kind of donations you can make. And then, of course, beer. Beer is always welcome. Okay, I think I'm done. Yeah, of course, if you have questions, I'm sure I haven't covered everything. I tried to mention, like, interesting pieces, but maybe not all of them.
So we'll take questions, and afterwards Michael is going to do collections for the OpenBSD hackathon.
Okay.
Okay. So you might want to mention that too.
Okay. Yes. Because they already finished the Linux port, and now they're selling it as a service on their HPD machines. They give so much. They have an option now. You can buy HPB machine from HP with HPX or Linux. So now they're done with it. They have several projects they working currently, I think, on the SMP support on the very new HPBA 64 machines, because it doesn't work very well and all the other stuff. But then again, they never gave us anything. We asked for documentation several times. They said, yeah, blah, blah, we're not going to do it. But for the Linux project, they released. Well, they gave people on the NDA, and you have to give credit to the Puffin group. They said, well, NDA is good, but we would like it to share with other people. and the several specifications being released. For example, the books I mentioned before, the PA-RISC architecture, they contain basic instruction set, basic CPU functionality, but they don't tell you how to operate the TLB, for example, properly. They give you the ideas, the instructions, but apparently there are much better instructions. HP has this about 60 instructions total, major instructions. There are some modifications to them, but then they have one magic instruction called diagnostic, and it has 19, I think, bits, or what is it, 18 and 5 bits, something like that. It was like 20 something bits, which could be anything. And apparently there they have one instruction, which is fast TLB load, which is twice as fast as whatever is in the book. And then there is instruction to put the entries in the, there is a way, several instructions, those diagnostic instructions. For each, apparently, HP has mnemonics and everything. It just the whole instruction subset, which is not documented, and which makes HPX work better than anything else, because they know how to deal with it. And of course, the noodles don't know about it, so if you dump the HPX kernel, they just give you hex. Okay, diagnostic, blah, hex number. What it does, I don't... So, that part, they released two docs for two CPU types. And they didn't release that for any of the 64-bit CPUs, even though they have them, of course. They didn't release it for three other types of CPUs, 32-bit CPUs. They released just for two, so that's what, two out of five, 40%. And then they released the dock for interface to the graphics cards, that small, tiny thing which allows you to do, in effect, more or less efficient console access. And but then we knew that because Mike Hibbler and the guys, they already had the driver for that. So that was still useful because we figured out a few things which we could do much more efficient than we were doing it before. And they released a couple of docs on these GSC bus controllers, the little bridges for two of them out of three. And some other stuff, but still, thanks for that, but still not enough. And the problem, of course, is because every time they have to have the doc, give it to the lawyer, pay them like $500 an hour to read it out, scratch out all the names, scratch out all the mentions, yeah, okay, we stole this from Novell or whatever. And for them, it's a huge project, and somebody in HP has to actually do it. Some person inside HP has to come to the library they have in there, take the doc, write out the paper, go sign it with the like super duper manager, go to a lawyer, read it out, hit the lawyer on the head so he actually do it, and then get it out, put it in PDF, and publish PDF somewhere. It's a huge project, and they...
So do you think that equipment they gave you, is that a start of a relationship, or did that just get you off the phone?
No. They actually kind of came to us earlier. A guy who, in HP, they have this scrapyard where they put whatever internal HP machines they don't need, and the guy who kind of like manages the scrapyard, and they, I think 99 or maybe 2000, and then some of the Linux shows, the Linux guy took me to him and said, okay, here is Mickey, he does OpenBSD, and they, could you give him hardware? He said, yeah, no problem, write me anytime. And apparently that guy somehow disappeared, but then another one showed up and said, okay, no problem, here is the machines. And it didn't happen once. It happened in 2001, then it happened last year again. We asked for a few more machines for more developers, and they said, yeah, okay, we don't have as much as we had before, but here is something we have. And the first time they just rolled out the rack and said, if you have a truck, just come and get it. We were just too lazy to ship them out. And the 20 machines with the switch and 19-inch rack and the wheels and everything. And they said, well, sorry, but we cannot really deal with 20 machines, and not to mention the whole rack, about 10. I said, okay, so he sent 5 to Theo, 5 to me, and this huge wooden crate, the FedEx came with the forklift. And then they sent to US developers, Theo sent to Canadian developers, so we got 5. Four more developers involved in the States, 5 more developers involved in Canada, and then pretty much all of them did something. So that was useful. So they, I don't think they are more, just here, go away. No, I think they actually interested to support more. No, it's just normal machine. They, well, the machines we ask for is a, there are two, the most usable machines of the 32B series. It's a good ratio between performance and weight. They weigh about the B180, it weighs about 25 kilos, but it's not, what, about a little more than like 3U machine, but it's a desktop basically. You can put it sideways, you can put it flat. It's about 17 by 17 inch, about 3U high. It has two PCI slots, it has everything on board, it has a SCSI Ethernet, fast Ethernet on board, it has a video on board, what else? It has a bay for one hard drive, one CD, one floppy, so it's pretty much self-contained workstation. So we asked for those, they said, okay, we have those, here, have them. So we actually, they actually gave us what we needed, not something they just couldn't figure out what to do with. And the other machine is very good, is A180, which is a specifically made for rack mounting 2U machine without video, only serial console, which is very useful. Also two PCI slots, but the only problem, it has only narrow SCSI, but apparently it's enough for doing like make builds and stuff.
Did that also include the SMP machines?
Well, 32-bit SMP machines, we didn't even ask, because the smallest one weighs like 35 kilos. It's a 650 watts electricity and the heat as well. And it's about this wide and this normal like full tower machine with the slots on the back for CPUs and all other stuff. It's not like normal machine. There's some EISA slots, something else, but it's not very useful machine to have at home in a hub on. And that's the smallest one you can have for SMP. But for HPK64, they get the machine which is 2U machine, 2 CPUs, decent stuff. And again, I asked, can you give us 2 CPU 64-bit machines? Yeah, okay, we have one here. And they even shipped it to me with, no charge, nothing. So that was, I think now they've been much better. Maybe before they thought I would ask them to write code or something, I don't know. But then again, they already made the decision in 97 to do Linux. They didn't heavily involve in that, I think, until 98 or 99. Because initially, Puffing Group did some decent work, but then I don't know why they took over, but then Puffing Group got sold to LinuxCare, so we got the whole thing in there. I don't know why it happens like that.
Well, that is fun now, but was it fun going through the process? Because it sounds like there are a lot of painful things to get past.
Oh, it's always fun. partially, well, when you do it in the beginning, when you don't even have single user, when you don't have even virtual memory set up properly. For some reason, the debugging the initial bootstrap, which bootstraps the kernel, was very easy. It took a little while to figure out how everything works, but for some reason that went much less pain than the rest of the kernel. But then when the kernel is, there is no debugger, well, there is DDB, but before DDB happens, you have a whole bunch of code to write. And it's always build the kernel, boot it up, see what happens. Put a lot of printfs, boot it up, see what happens. Drink some beer. Build a new kernel, boot it up, see what happens. Drink some beer. So it's a crazy process. And when the HPP64 is much easier, because again, on the later HPP 32-bit machines, they made this. They call it the Guardian System Processor. But it's kind of like a loam on the Sun mattress. It's a little separate CPU with a separate Ethernet and a separate maybe serial port, which is in working condition as soon as you plug in the power. And through that card, you can power on off the whole machine, you can reset the machine, you can do something else. Some little other, I think dump memory or something. But anyway, remotely resetting the machine is already good. Because then you don't have, they don't have HP, they all HPBA machines, they don't have reset button. Just, there is no such concept. They have a button called transfer of control. It's like NMI, essentially. You push it, interrupt happens. If you don't have a handler, machine resets. But at the same time, CPU has a little non-volatile memory where the CPU state gets dumped. So if your machine hangs, you push the button, it reboots, and then you go looking at that little tiny memory and you can see what was in the registers. And that thing is very extremely useful because if it hangs, you don't know anything. And here you have like a little printf. It gives you everything you want to know. The address it where it hang, what was in the registers, and because the memory between the resets, the memory is not cleared. So when you look in that dump, you can manually unwind the stack. You can look at what was in the stack pointer. Okay, let's go subtract some and see what was the return pointer. So eventually you get the whole stack. It's manually the hex numbers. There is no symbols or anything, but it's still much more useful than just hang and then go try something else and go try another beer. And they, well, most of the new HPBA 64 machines, most of them, they already have that Guardian Professor on every machine. So every machine you just plug in two Ethernets, one in that funky stuff and one in the normal Ethernet, and then you can remotely do anything to it. You don't have to push the buttons, do not. You just power cycle it, or again, through the Guardian Professor, you can virtually push this transfer of control button, which is usually a very tiny, small thing somewhere in the deepest possible corner, so you cannot accidentally push it. So it's not very useful pushing it even with the pen or anything. And here you just push it from the keeper. Much more useful. So they are debugging friendly. And then again, partially maybe because the whole the hardware development in HP is that they develop one machine and then next model they develop on this machine. So there is always partially that makes them debug the existing system. Plus they put that knowledge into newer systems. And plus they actually understand what are the problems of using the machines. They were just making them, selling them, and without using in the actual development problem. And mainly partially because the target market for HPBA machines was always all kinds of design companies. Airplane designs, whatever designs, car designs, bridge designs, all kinds of companies which design stuff. They run all kinds of CAD applications on them, plus HP run their own CAD application. And one of those, they have this HPBA emulator, which emulates, everybody knows about it, but everybody denies this, so it, because legend says whoever takes it out of HP gets shot on sight. So people deny they even saw it. But the legends are they have this emulator of CPU which emulates on the CPU cycle level. So you run your whatever program you have, and you can see where you're wasting clocks on anything. You can actually calculate how much time you wasted running, for example, main build on the whole system. How much time you wasted waiting for memory, for example. Or how much time you wasted in the TOB handlers. And the so it's an enormous profiling tool for, of course, micro-optimization, but it's still useful for frequently executed code. Like the page fault handlers, they executed like 10, 20 million per make build, or maybe more. No more questions? There is no hardware implementation for context switch.
But then there's privacy built on the memory.
What's privacy?
You said that in the memory address
the first 50 bits. Oh, then it, well, basically you can say it's a Well, the closest analogy that actually HP uses is just extension of the address. So technically, they are not 32-bit address machines. They are 48-bit address machines. We use only 15 because the way we implement virtual memory, that's a different thing. But technically, they have 48-bit address, which is only low 32-bit are actually user-accessible, but the top 16 are set by kernel for each program. So when it accesses virtual, it's virtual space. It's not overlapping with all the other ones. But every TLB entry has, of course, read-write-execute bits. Well, it doesn't have read bit, but it has write-bit, execute bit, which also allows for non-executable page protection, which we implement for a whole bunch of things. And they don't have much. Well, they have funny stuff in TLB, which I don't think anybody uses, including HPX. They have a bit, which means whenever branch happens into this page, give me interrupt. And it may be useful for like debugging, but nobody had it figuring out how to use it. And they have like three or four bits like that. They have one bit, which is whenever a page is referenced, give me interrupt, which is useful watch points, but everybody implements software watch points anyway. And when they have cache inhibit, and don't put the page in the cache when you just get access. But then again, it's implemented on like three CPUs, but not on the other two. So it's not very reliable stuff. They have promotion bits. So let's say for the system call page, there are four bits which control how you can promote privilege through accessing that page. So you can have a page by branching into which you automatically it becomes in kernel, but only for particular access modes and the blah. But then again, it's very specific use. Maybe HPX uses it for something, but I think they just over-designed it a little bit. For virtual memory design that only PSDs have, they more than enough, like half of the stuff they have in there. But okay. So, yeah, but there is no problem. We do context switching manually. We still store and restore. Everybody does it. Well, HPX does it in the software, in the actual program as well. And that's why it's good, because you know how to do it efficiently instead of CPU doing it in some generic way like i386 does. It just dumps everything. But maybe you don't need to dump everything. You need to dump just half of it, or just a little tiny bit of it, or some particular pieces of it. Of course, and that makes CPU simpler, so they can put more caches on the CPU, for example, or they can just put more functional units on the CPU, or more renaming registers, or all kinds of stuff. So on some older CPUs, they had these. On the CPU, they had the funny cache, which is 1 kilobyte. It's not a page, it's 1 kilobyte, it's not visible to software, nothing. It's sort of like the instruction queue on the Intel CPUs, which is 16 bytes. But there is 1 kilobyte, which is get constantly loaded. And it's only for code, it contains only instructions. And while the program executes, it gets loaded with the instructions all the time. Kind of like a queue a little bit. And if the branch happens, it gets cleared and then loaded again really, really fast. And then again, in that magic instruction set, they don't tell anybody about. They have instructions to manipulate the queue, but why would you need to manipulate it? I don't know, it's completely transparent. So they have lots of strange stuff in the CPU, which I don't think they use either. But why they have it, I don't know. Maybe just because we can. We still have space on the crystal. Let's put new stuff in there.
Actually, that's a good question. How much of the CPU,
how many instructions are implemented? Well, on the main CPU, they don't have microcoded instructions. They're all about 4 or 5 cycles each. And the FPU multiplication is actually also hardware. Division, they don't have one instruction. They have a division step instruction. which you do like 32 or something times, and they insert add and shift and or subtract and shift and so you division, you always have a software, but then division may not happen that often. Maybe that's what they decided. And then like for you, they decided you don't have to implement all the instructions on the FPU. Stupid instructions like converting float or double into integer or long. Why implement that in the hardware? Software can do it. How often that happens? Like one every 10 floating point instructions or one every 20 floating point instructions. So the interrupt happens and we have little tiny software which does it. So even on the CPUs, which are 90% of the HPPA CPUs have FPU, we still have to have an FPU emulation because CPU doesn't have to implement all the FPU instructions. And for some instructions, it doesn't implement corner cases. Like for addition or something, if they have inexact loss of precision, inexact result basically, they call you and say, yeah, okay, this shit happened. You deal with it if you wanna. If you don't wanna, oh, okay, this result is fine with me, blah, blah. And if you wanna remember these lost bits or something, you deal with it. So, say addition works, but then in some cases you still have to replace it in one like 10 billion cases, but it still happens. So then they specifically in the book they say you don't know which instructions implemented or not. If they're not, they you get called. But again, the reason they did it this way, they ran this huge profiling on the real applications, real operating system, and they figure it out. This happens 1 zillion billion times, and this happens only once. So let's make this faster and forget about this. User can deal with it.
So the FPU emulation is
based on hard. Well, of course it's slower. First of all, the interrupt happens. That's already like 10, 15 cycles penalty because all the execution queues get cleared, blah, blah, but that happens on any architecture. And then you have to decode the instruction. That's another maybe 20 instructions. Oh, then the algorithm, because HP wrote it, we can say that, say, multiplication done in FPU and in emulation would produce the same result. We can say that, but I don't think anybody ever verified that. I made the code that allows disabling FPU completely around on emulation, and apparently that doesn't work very well, so there are probably some bugs in FPU, but with the enabled FPU, it kind of works. Well, it works reliably, like make build works, most of the application works. There are a couple of very evil packages that make GCC go crazy, but maybe that's GCC fault, nobody knows, but GCC just gets stuck, it has to be killed, but then next time it works, and then it might not work, but GCC is separate much.
GCC says that it's not reproducible, it's not a problem
with GCC. Well, GCC is well, say, well, you think a problem, send a bunch, okay, thank you. All right, so who...
Do we have
any
questions or anything?
Just a reminder, if you put the slide back up, there are two things about donations. One was about money, hardware donations, which you can take
another beer donation.
buying a t-shirt, giving $50 or more. The other, the beer part, can be dealt with the dancing, which, as the tradition is, the speaker should never pay for a drink tonight. So...
Is that good for me? Huh? No, they'll run those desserts. I don't like that idea. Some people say, yeah, it's cool, I have this little tiny computer I can go drinking beer with. And then I figure, if I'm gonna do that, I can buy beer and sit at home and have 10 of them. What's the point going drinking beer out and have it steal a machine with me? Well, that's my opinion, but apparently people like that, well, fine. But I just not that interested in that kind of machines myself, so I haven't even looked in the ARM code at all. We did the, last year I think, we did the AMD64 port. That was interesting because I think three developers did it. It was a, I forgot who started it even then, Art Grabowski, who is in Sweden, he almost made it working. There were several bugs left, but then he couldn't figure it all, or maybe just lost interest. And then I was looking into that. So we had three developers making AMD64 up to single user. And then they had about 10 developers making the whole user land works. So we started about in March, and the release was in May. So in the March, April, we made it up to multi-user, and then we made the X3 working, and we had the release in the May, which is probably the fastest ever OpenBSD port done, even though it's based on NetBSD port, but still, we never had anything for the that fast before. It's about 2 months and a half, and we have AMD64 in usable condition. It wasn't like crashing or dying all the time. And what else did we do?
Average number of developers per report, I mean, in terms of people?
Not really. Say, Motorola 88K, there is like two people doing it. HPP, well, I do it, and then there are several developers who once in a while contribute time to it. But AMD64 was probably the most people participating in one given time frame in making the stuff work. Partially because the hardware, it's not very cheap, but it's comparable to, and very available as any other Intel kind of hardware. And plus, you can run it in normal Intel mode. So lots of people already had the motherboard with the CPUs, they were just running in the normal Intel mode. And then, oh, there is an AMD64 port, let's load it up, fix it up, okay, now we are like twice faster.
AMD is pretty good.
Well, they initially give two or three machines, but they're like AMD development machines. They have BIOS and the CPU version, which you cannot buy anywhere. This the AMD was actually developing the BIOS and the AMD and the CPU with. And they gave those machines, but of course they were AMD development machines. They had problems with the PCI breach, there was some data corruption and other stuff. But on those machines, we got to the point where I came, then we bought a couple of motherboards. Motherboards are cheap, the CPUs are a little expensive actually. And we bought a couple of motherboards, and, one for me, one another guy. I forgot where is he, maybe at Canada. And then we did about a month, then a whole bunch of people came who already had the hardware, and they just, yeah, okay, cool, it's faster than Intel, let's use it. What are they? Well, ARM, Zaro's port is kind of massive developing as well. There is like five or six developers working in different parts of it. And, but other ports are not that really popular. AK, it's a nice architecture, it's not very fast, it's like 33 gigahertz max CPU speed. But again, like two people on Alpha, I don't think anybody works on Alpha. people work once in a while, but what else is very... Well, on Spark there are several people, but then Spark was done long ago. Spark is like stable architecture now, nothing major happens there. There has been huge development for the frame buffer drivers. We got like 10 new ones.
I'm sorry, I need to interrupt for a second. I apologize.
Okay.
My name is Ken Court. I'm in charge of servers and storage for our business unit. I desperately need Solaris and IRX Race to email me because I may have work for you. So if you can email SohoBusiness@apple.com. And it doesn't need to be newer Solaris, I'll just keep it. If you are a Solaris or IRX Ray, especially with the Sun stuff, if you're like a Sun Ray, if you've ever done a big Sun Ray deployment or something like that, you can email, it'd be very, very helpful to me, because I can give you some more. Okay? I appreciate it. I meant no
problem. No, after all, we can come there and install all the business then. Oh, then the HGI port was kind of up to us as well. They came out, the guy from Norway or Sweden, I always forget, somewhere in the CD anyway, Terrafogis from. He was working on it about the same, since the same, the moment I started HPP port. I found this stuff, I asked him, like, you're working on SGI in 97, do you have any source? Yeah, I have this little source, we should not do anything. And he committed it about last year, but then again, lots of people suddenly came to help, because apparently you can buy O2 machines on eBay for a couple of hundred bucks, which is not that bad. HPP machines, most of them, almost every week you can find a decent machine for about 200 bucks, 150 bucks. 32-bit machines. So it's not that hard to find at all. For some reason, there was a huge amount of them in Germany and in Canada, Toronto. I don't know why in Toronto, but some couple of three guys in Toronto were selling them on eBay, like every day, new one, for about 150 Canadian, was nothing. Only just shipment going to be an evil 25 kilos. Otherwise, it's okay. All right.
Well,
thank you.
Evil. Again, Michael will be taking care of donations for OpenBSD Hackathon. $50 or more, you get a free Nice Bug t-shirt, our first t-shirts. They should go quick. The logo on the front, on the back, is a customized D-message with a few little Easter eggs in there. You don't get a prize if you find them.
I have a better D-message.
it's actually a merge of all the architectures. Also, there's some free books to give away. And also, finally, we still, believe it or not, we still have some holiday party swag bags left over from December. So
carry your T-shirt home, isn't it?
Yeah, you can carry your T-shirt. And if you get lucky, you might find a New York Internet T-shirt in there. So